1 Samuel 8, the fifth talk in a series on 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on December 3, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 1 Samuel chapter 8. We're just going to look at one chapter today. It's a significant chapter. It's a difficult chapter. There's lots to talk about, and there are lots of interpretive decisions that have to be made, and I need you to follow along and check me. Last week, we talked about the situation in which the Philistines returned the ark that they had taken in battle. The Israelites had the great idea that if they took the Ark of the Covenant into battle with them, that surely they would be victorious. And when they did so, they were defeated soundly, and the ark was taken. So the Philistines, having captured the ark, took it and put it in a temple of their god, Dagon, and twice the statue fell over, bowed down in front of the ark. And then the Philistines were inflicted with some plagues, and as a result they decided this is a dangerous thing for us to have around, so they wanted to get rid of it. And the question was, how do you return an ark? What's the protocol? And they talked to their priests to try to figure out how you do that. And the priests came up with a way to do that, which included giving an offering that's suitable for those situations where you have taken something that's not yours. And I was thinking about that during the week. It is interesting that the Philistines would have an offering that was similar to an offering that is a part of the religion that God gave to Israel through Moses at Mount Sinai. That the Israelite religion, as it was given by God, contains a lot of elements that were common to the religions around them. In some instances, there are very parallel features in the religion. For instance, the tabernacle, the tent, the portable temple that was made by the Israelites, apparently there were very similar kinds of things that were used by the surrounding cultures. The Ark of the Covenant itself was designed to be this box that has a seat on top of it that God sits on. Well, that's very comparable to some elements of the religions that surrounded the Israelites. So when God gave this religion, these religious practices, these customs to the Israelites, he drew heavily upon the customs of the surrounding people. In some instances, though, he made the Israelite religion was to be very different. And some of those are they weren't supposed to have idols. In the other surrounding religions, they all had idols. God said, let there be no graven images. Don't try to depict me in a physical form. They weren't supposed to sacrifice pigs. Pigs were commonly sacrificed, certainly in Palestine. In fact, that was one of the most prized sacrifices, was pigs. And yet the Israelites were told not to do that. So there are some instances in which the Israelite religion copies, it borrows features from the other religions. In other instances, the features of the Israelite religion was to be distinctly different. And I think that's interesting, because what God apparently chose to do is to give Israel religious practices that were speaking in the language of the cultures around them. It was using the symbols as a language to help communicate what God wanted to communicate, but he communicated something new and different through that language. And so he borrows these forms, but he gives those forms new and different content. That's interesting to me, and that's kind of reassuring, because as I think about how to communicate with our culture, I want to communicate in the language of our culture. But when you do that, you run a risk. It may make it more accessible on the one hand, but on the other hand, you run the risk of encouraging people to invest the content of the surrounding culture into those forms and not allow you to say something different with it. You see what I'm saying? And that apparently did happen. We see the Israelites wanting to, they are importing some content from their surrounding culture, not just using some of the forms. So, for instance, when they carry the ark into battle with them, they're thinking about things in a very pagan fashion. They aren't treating the ark the way God intended it to be treated. They're treating it as something different. And so there's indications here that they have imported content that's filling in those forms that were God-given forms. I think that's interesting, and it will be relevant to what we talk about today in chapter 8. The first section, verses 1 through 9. And it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint us a king for us to judge us like all the nations." But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice, however, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them." So Samuel's getting old. It's not clear exactly when this is happening. Samuel judged for a number of years, but it never tells us exactly how many years Samuel judged. But the events that are being described here occur about 25 years before he dies. So he's old, but he is still going to live at least another 25 years. So he's getting old, and the Israelites are kind of looking at the situation. Things have been stable under Samuel. For a number of years, things have been stable, and the Israelites have been able to keep the Philistines at bay. But now Samuel's getting old, and they look at his sons. And he has two sons that are wicked sons. It's interesting, we saw earlier that Eli, the high priest, had two sons, and both of them were wicked and corrupt. And there, it was not clear that Eli had been consistently a man of God and righteous. The text doesn't make it really clear. So one could speculate that maybe earlier in his life he hadn't dealt with his sons well. But here we have a situation in which there has been no criticism of Samuel whatsoever. There's no indication that Samuel has been wayward at all. So we have a righteous man who has raised two sons who become wicked and corrupt. And I think it's interesting and worthy of note that and this has been mentioned before, but I think it is an important thing that our children are not our own. We cannot discipline our children into eternity, into heaven. They are going to make their own decisions, and that's good and proper, because faith it can only be come to by the person himself. No one else can have faith for you. And as parents, we need to realize that the role that we play in our children's life, that's just a bit part. It's an important bit part, but still it's just a bit part. Mainly what happens that affects their soul is them doing business with God, and we can't insert ourselves in the middle of that. In any case, they're looking at the situation where Samuel has two sons who have become wicked. And apparently they're disturbed by that, because apparently they're thinking Samuel's been a very good judge. Things have been very stable for a period of time. We've had good leadership. It would be nice if his sons could play that same role. But that's not going to happen. So the elders of Israel are looking for an alternative. How can we perpetuate this? How can we maintain this kind of stability that we have had for the last number of years? So they come to Samuel and they say, "You're getting old. Before you die, please do something for us. Please appoint a king." So the solution that they have to their problem seems to be, if we just had a king. And I suspect what they've done is they've looked around at the surrounding cultures and they say, they're looking at their situation. They see that for about 200 years, they have been without centralized leadership. They've been disparate tribes trying to take control of the areas in which they live. Sometimes some of them coming together against a common foe, but in other respects staying quite separate. And periodically God would raise someone up and give that person the charisma to be able to get the kind of leader following that was necessary to go against one of their oppressors. And one of those judges would rise up, provide that kind of leadership for a period of time, then that judge would die, and Israel once again would be without leadership until God would raise up another person to provide that kind of leadership. So the elders are looking at this and they're saying, This is not a stable situation. This is not a secure situation. What we need is a long-term solution to our problem. We need consistent leadership and effective leadership so that we can drive back these oppressors and have peace and security. So they come to Samuel and they say, "Appoint a king. That's the solution to our problem." And Samuel's response was, "This is not good." But he takes this issue before God and appeals to him. What should I do here? And God confirms Samuel's impression. This is not good. And this is not a rejection of you, Samuel, you need to understand, but this is a rejection of my leadership. And this is not a new phenomenon. That from the time that these people left Egypt, it has been the same. That consistently, they have been resistant to my leadership. Back then, it was through Moses, and they complained about Moses' leadership. And if you'll recall in Exodus, there are a couple of times when God says, they aren't complaining about, it's not you they're rebelling against, it's me that they're rebelling against. So this is not a new phenomenon. It has happened ever since they left Egypt. But what God says to do is listen to their voice, provide them with a king, but you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. You need to caution them what the implications of this will be. Next section. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked him of him a king. And he said, "This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing, and to reap his harvest, and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. So the warning is, you need to think soberly about this choice that you're making. If a king is appointed, it is inevitable that there will be certain things that will follow. And the things that will follow is he is going to take for himself, he's going to take your sons, and they are going to serve in various capacities in his administration. Some are going to run in front of his chariots, and he'll have horsemen. Some will serve in the military, commanders of thousands and fifties. Some will serve in overseeing his household to do his plowing and reap his harvest. Some will serve in the military industrial complex, making weapons of war, equipment for his chariots. Besides his sons, he's going to take your daughters. They'll be perfumers, cooks, bakers. So he's going to take your youth, and they're going to serve him. Besides that, he's going to take property. He's going to take fields and vineyards and olive groves. He's going to take a tenth of what you produce, so income taxes. And then it lists servants, male servants, female servants, your young men, your donkeys, and use them for his work, etc. And you yourselves will become his servants. All of this is going to happen. This is inevitable. It's foreseeable. All of this will be necessary in order for the king to carry out his business. He's going to do all of this stuff. And the end result is you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. So it will come to the place where you will not like this arrangement. This arrangement will be oppressive. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. God is going to allow you to reap what you have sown. God is going to allow you to suffer the natural consequences of the choice that you have made, and will not provide you relief from that. Next section. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." Now after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the Lord's hearing. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to their voice and appoint them a king." So Samuel said to the men of Israel, "Go every man to his city." So even having listened to the warning, the people of Israel said, "Give us a king. We want the king." They were desperate for this solution, adamant that this is the way out of their dilemma. So that we may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. I love that. Clearly the king is not going to fight their battles. They're going to fight their battles, but it feels good to have the king out there doing it. So Samuel, he hears what they've said, and as God had told him, he says he will grant their request. He tells them he will appoint a king, and for now, go home and I'll be working on it. I'll take care of this. I want to talk about this incident a bit, and then I'm hoping to leave plenty of time for comments and questions, because I think this is worth discussion. Let me read a section in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy had foreseen this event. There's a very interesting section, Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 through 20. Let me read this, starting with 14. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he increase silver and gold for himself. Now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, and that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, in order that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. In the past, I've always looked at this as a prediction of what would happen, that there would come a time in Israel when they got settled into the land, that they would do an evil thing and that they would ask for a king. In looking at it now more recently, I'm not sure that's what was intended in Deuteronomy. It is simply the case that when a society becomes more mature and more developed, it has different needs. So as the Israelites settle in, as they increase in number, as they develop their economy, as the society just matures and grows, it's going to have greater needs, and that includes greater administrative needs. And as a result, there is going to be this problem. What are we going to do? How are we going to fix this problem? And it's not unreasonable to think that a king might be a solution to that particular problem. So in Deuteronomy, I'm no longer as certain that what was intended is there will be this evil thing that you will ask. But rather, it's just the comment that there will be this inevitable thing that will happen. Inevitably, the needs will become so complex and so great for some kind of administration that you will ask for a king. But what it goes on to say in Deuteronomy, I think, is, but in taking that step, there is a lot of danger, and you need to be aware of that. That in taking that step, you run the risk of creating this monster, in a sense. And how do you keep it from being a monster? Well, here are the safeguards, and it lists the things. That it shall be one who is chosen by me, one from your countrymen. He shall not multiply horses. He shall not multiply wives. He ought not increase his silver and gold for himself. And then in the last section where it talks about he needs to copy out the law. Isn't it every year? No, it's when he comes. Just copy out the law. It doesn't say how often. So he needs to be thoroughly familiar with the law in order that he might not transgress that. So I think in Deuteronomy, that's probably what was intended, is just recognition that inevitably the administrative needs will be greater. You will need to have some solution to that problem. A king is what other people have used, and that's what you are going to want to use. So why, if that's the case, why does God characterize this request that comes to Samuel as being a rejection of God himself? The elders, I suspect they were familiar with Deuteronomy. They knew that this passage was in here. And they're seeing this as permission to make this request. Authorization to make this request. And yet God sees it as a rejection of him. I suspect that's because of the spirit with which they are bringing this request. It seems to me that when we have a problem, it is not unreasonable to look around to see how other people have solved that problem. For instance, if my roof is leaking, it's not unreasonable for me to find out if my neighbor has had a similar problem and how my neighbor has fixed that. And it might be very appropriate for me to do exactly what my neighbor did. I'm learning from my neighbor's experience and my neighbor's the wisdom that my neighbor has gained. If I've got another problem, say I'm wondering how to discipline my children, it would not be inappropriate to look at my neighbor and see how my neighbor has disciplined his children. But I have to be careful and take into account whatever solution my neighbor has come up with, they come out of some set of values, some understanding of what's important in the world. And as I look at my neighbor and my neighbor's experience, I need to evaluate whether that solution is appropriate for the values that I have gleaned from the Bible, appropriate for biblical values. If it's not, it needs to be rejected. Now, it could be that I look at my neighbor's experience and there are parts of what my neighbor has done that I can learn from and that can be adapted for my own use and made consistent with the values that I glean from the Bible. If so, fine. I can do that. Or it could be that his solution is so out of sync with biblical values that it needs to be rejected altogether. The important thing is it is good and proper for us to learn from the experience of others around us. But we can't do so lazily. We need to be careful and conscious of the fact that those solutions all arise out of a set of values, and is that then an appropriate solution for me? Can it be adapted, or does it need to be rejected for my purposes? So the Israelites, in looking and facing their problem is they want security and stability. Is it inappropriate for them to look around at the neighboring countries and see how they have solved that problem? Not at all. But is it inappropriate for them to borrow that solution, lock, stock, and barrel, if that solution is grounded in values that are not biblical? No, that's not proper. What the Israelites are facing is a situation in which they're worried about their security in the face of the Philistines who have been pressing them. And they don't know when the next judge will come along. They want continuity that will provide security and stability. And as they look at the way things are being done under Samuel and under the judges, as they see it, this priority of security and stability is not receiving adequate attention. So they want a form of governance that's more grounded, that is more responsive to them. a solution, a form of government that's more political in the sense that it grows out of the people. They want a more this-worldly form of government. And I think that God perceives that ultimately what they want is a more manipulable form of government. They want to have more say. They want to be able to raise their concern for security and stability to a higher priority than it seems to have under the judges. Now, you could say, well, most kings at that time, their power was inherited. And if the power is inherited, how is establishing a kingship political? How is that more responsive to the people? And one of the things that I have learned through my studies of history, and something that has surprised me actually, is kings don't have as much power as you would think. And in fact, their power grows out of the people. They are heavily dependent on the people that are subject to them. And I think it's interesting that in my study of Russian history, there were tsars that complained that they couldn't get their will done because the people wouldn't do it. If the people won't do it, the king can't get his will done. The king is ultimately powerless without the cooperation of other people, whether it's administrators, whether it's the army, he needs a lot of cooperation to be able to get things done. So a king is very subject to the will of his subjects. And we ought not underestimate that. And I think that the Israelites understand this. They understand that the kingships that exist in the surrounding countries are, to one degree or another, responsive to the people. The question is, to who will inherit the power? Well, you say, well, it goes to the oldest son. Well, it doesn't always go to the oldest son. There are times in which the people, one way or another, insert themselves into that and make changes as to who inherits power. Sometimes kings are forced out of power. But even in just normal day activities, the king has advisors, the king has servants, and they all have influence on the decisions that the king makes. So it is the case that if Israel had a king, that king would be more subject to the influence from the people. He would be more approachable, in a sense, or at least seemingly, and would be more influenceable than is God and the judges. Now, once a king is established, there are a number of things that seem to naturally follow from that. And the first is the problem of authority. Why is it that the people in a society should do whatever this king says? If he is just one of us, why should he be in a position where what he says everybody has to obey? And that, so authority has to be established. Now the king can use force. Kings and other leaders throughout history have used force to make sure that their will is carried out, that obedience is done. But force is a very inefficient way to run a society. It takes humongous resources to do that. And it doesn't work very well in the long term. So in the ancient world, it was not primarily force that got people to obey the king. What they would do is elevate the king so that he was not just another one of us. The king is special stuff. The king is half God. The king is he has special powers, special prerogatives, and special glory. And in order to create that, you have to make this aura around the king of ceremonies, of pomp and circumstance, that you relate to him differently. A whole set of customs about how you come into the presence of the king, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is designed to increase the impression that this king is special stuff and therefore is worthy of obedience. And the more people are resistant to the rule of the king, the more the need for that becomes. And all of that takes money and resources. So it is inevitable that you establish a king, it's going to cost you something. Even apart from that, centralized administration is going to take resources. You're going to have people keeping records. You're going to have places to store the records. You're going to have people to gather the information that's put in those records. You're going to have all kinds of stuff. So that's going to be the case regardless of who is king and regardless of who are the people that are being ruled. But the more rebellious the people, the more resources that are going to be necessary in order to keep control of those people. The king is going to have more glory if the people are rebellious. You're going to have more administration to keep things under control. And all of that is going to cost you more money. So the more rebellious, the more expensive, and the more oppressive that the government is going to be. Why do kings tend to become tyrants? It is part of our sinful nature that we are attracted to power and wealth. Any king, any leader that has the opportunity to amass power and wealth is going to be tempted to do so. But I'm convinced that part of that process is aided by the people as well, that they are also culpable. Jacques Ellul, in his book Propaganda, argues that propaganda comes into being not just because there are evil propagandists who want to do something to people, who want to manipulate their minds, but it's actually a two-way street, that it is at least as much a result of people wanting to be propagandized as it is the propagandist wanting to exercise his power and influence. And what he argues is there is something that we as people want to get out of life, and particularly in the modern world, where some of the most basic things that people used to get other ways, those old ways of getting those things, such as a sense of significance, a place, a sense of identity, a purpose. All of those were given through our communities in the past, through small communities. And the modern world has destroyed that structure, such that we can't get those things readily from our small communities anymore. But there's something in us that wants those desperately. Those are needs that are built into us, seemingly. So the propagandist is therefore recruited by the people, encouraged by the people, to come and solve that problem. Give me significance. Give me identity. Give me a place in this world. And the propagandist says, well, I can do that. I can give you a reasonable facsimile of that in exchange for you granting me your will. That's the devil's deal that's worked out in propaganda. But what's interesting about that, and something that I have never thought about before, is Ellul is pointing out that propaganda comes about as much because we want it as because there's a propagandist who wants to do it. Similarly, I think the same is true of tyranny. That is, tyranny comes about not just because there's a nasty man who wants to tyrannize, but also because there are people who want to be tyrannized. What generally happens is people want security and stability to be a high priority, if not the highest priority. And the tyrant is willing to do that by bringing in force. He can create a facsimile of security and stability. So tyranny, I think, happens when people place security and stability as a higher priority than righteousness, even. When things are tough, the main question should be, how do I be faithful in the midst of this? And not, how do I get out of this? To ask first, how do I get out of this, is the road to tyrannization. So should the Israelites have asked for a king? I'm inclined to think now, no, that it wasn't wrong for them to ask for a king. But to want a king because they were desperate for security, that was wicked. It was the attitude with which they asked for a king that was truly wicked. And there was going to be a price to be paid for that choice, and God was going to allow them to pay that price and was not going to respond to their appeals for relief from their oppression once it was established. We need to recognize, and they needed to recognize, that a king can't give the kind of security that would truly satisfy them in the long run. The king can only give a facsimile of security and a kind of security that will never really satisfy. And to establish a king and ask him to give the kind of security that satisfies is wicked and will result in a worsened condition. The only kind of security that is enduring is coming to trust that whatever happens to me, God is in control of those circumstances, and he loves me and will do right by me. Any other kind of security is a false security. It won't last. It can't last. And it will only be a facsimile of security. And to chase after that is to get into trouble, regardless of how we chase after that. Okay. Those are my comments. I have left lots of time for questions and comments from you, and I would invite them.
I don't know that I have the best picture of how the government was before the king. Mm-hmm. What, obviously it was something.
It wasn't much, I think, is the answer. That things apparently were locally administered, and I would assume that it was much along the lines of how things were done as they moved through the desert. They didn't have a central administration. They had villages, and I would assume that the villages were run by the elders, and it was largely family-based. So the dominant unit in the society seems to have been the family, and then, secondarily, then the tribes. But there wasn't a central administration. There was no central administration. There was nothing that coordinated the efforts of the whole nation of Israel. Judges, there was no formal form of the courts. That those were provided by charismatic leaders who would rise up and provide that kind of service.
And the judges, there must have been, were there a lot of judges? The people just grant them authority, and if they weren't good judges, then they didn't grant them the authority? Or?
There were quite a few judges. We see Samuel served as a judge, and he would go from one city to the other, and he appointed his sons as judges. So there must have been a number of judges. And presumably you went to the judge for whom you had respect. So it wasn't highly structured. So whatever existed before this time, it was not highly structured. It's rather chaotic.
So is it jumping like way too late ahead and speculative to comment on our government and our governmental forms? And I mean, obviously, I mean, I can't even imagine something like that working when you've got so many people.
Right.
And so something has to give.
And that's what's made me reconsider how I was interpreting what's in Deuteronomy. Because in the past, I thought, well, that was just a wicked thing that the people were going to ask for a king. And now I'm not so sure that that's the case. Because with the development of a more complex society, it seems to me that it was inevitable that they were going to need a more structured administration. And so a king was a reasonable solution to that. But the problem is, how are you viewing the king as a solution? What are you looking to the king for? And if you're primarily looking to the king to provide security and stability, and that's the number one thing you expect from the king, what you're going to get ultimately is slavery. But if what you're looking to the king for is more minimal, that is, well, I don't know if it's more minimal. It's different. It's create a situation in which we can pursue righteousness. All of us, including you, the king. And whatever shape that takes, that's fine. But our number one goal is righteousness and not security and stability. And if the people or the king get that inverted and go for security and stability, there's going to be trouble. And I think what we have in Deuteronomy, after it says this is what's going to happen, and you'll have a king, what it's listing are things to keep in mind that can help to forestall that natural slide into slavery. I used to think that there was a particular government that would be God's recommendation for mankind. I'm less likely to think that that's the case. I'm inclined to think now that the form of government, there are some forms of government that I think work better than others. But really, the form of government in a society is a minor consideration, all in all. What is much more significant is, what are people oriented towards? What are their values? And you could have a very bad form of government work quite well if people were rightly oriented. And you could have a very good form of government work very poorly if people are valuing the wrong things. Did I answer your question?
Maybe this is anticipating things you're going to say later on as you go along, but I'm just inviting you to comment on the fact that this evil request for a king led ultimately to Christmas carols, where we're singing about the King of Israel coming. And I'm not going to comment. I'm inviting you to comment.
Right. It is a phenomenal thing. And in order to answer that, once again, I have to refer to Jacques Ellul. Jacques Ellul wrote a book called The Meaning of the City, The Meaning of City, where he traces through the Old Testament the significance of city. And as he understands it, city comes on takes on a certain connotation, a certain set of values. It's not just talking about a geographical and social phenomenon, but it's talking about a mindset. And his observation is that the first city in the Bible was constructed by Cain in his rebelliousness against God. And as we trace the significance of city through the Bible, what we see is it becomes this image of the condensation of all of the wickedness in mankind. It's kind of the collecting point for the worst in humanity. And that's the way that that's what it comes to stand for in the biblical story. But what is phenomenal is that the new heavens and the new earth are not going back to the country, but it's a new city. So what God has done is taken something that we created in our sinfulness and rebelliousness and redeemed that form for his own use. And that seems to be the case with the kingship, at least as it's established here in Israel, that it is first established in rebelliousness. But as things progress, what is God going to do? Is he going to destroy that form? No, he's not going to destroy that form. He's going to redeem that form and use it for his purposes. And Christ will rule as king, which I find hugely encouraging, because that's what he does with all of us, is in our rebelliousness and sinfulness, we do a lot of evil. But it is God's creative activity that takes that evil that we have done and redeems it for his purposes, and out of it, he is able to produce good. And I find that very reassuring.
It seems apparent that what these people wanted was not righteousness. They wanted security. Mm-hmm. I mean, while that makes sense humanly, it seems very short-sighted, because here they are, they're having these judges who are Samuel's son, who are not judging well, who are wicked. What made them think that a king, or all the bureaucracy that's involved with the king, would be less corrupt? It would seem like the more people you have involved, the more the chance of more corruption. Mm-hmm.
My guess is that what they're doing is looking around at the surrounding cultures, and what they see is, if you have the problem with what they have is it's charisma based. That is, someone has power because people see that person as having some kind of special relationship with God. If that's the case, it's hard to bring political forces to bear on that. But as they look around at the surrounding cultures, kings are, to some degree, subject to political pressures. So I think that's what they're responding to, and they're seeing that is a more, I don't know how to describe it, it's a more humanly based form of administration, and therefore is more subject to political and human forces.
So they made this sort of pragmatic decision then, that made a trade, basically.
Sure, but we do that all the time. Our lust for comfort causes us to make lots of short-sighted decisions, because we just, to be in an uncomfortable situation, and we can use stronger words, agonizing situations. It is difficult to be in an agonizing situation and not have the desire to be out of this the number one consideration. And yet, to do so is short-sighted. But that's a difficult thing to come to understand.
This is kind of a subject I've got quite interested in my life is religion and politics. And I was reading one time, and I forgot which president it was before they started federal government being the main source of government. And he warned the Congress and stuff and the people and says, if you do this, if you open the doors to the federal government, it will never stop of the needs for the people that will go to the federal government. And I find that that's when you're talking about the evils of having a king and stuff, that's what's going to happen. Is people going to want that federal government to take care of every problem it is, and they do nothing. So I've always had this feeling that in life, it's the individual thinking of doing their own thing or taking care of their own problems in the family unit, and of course their religious view. If you've got all kinds of religious, like the United States, it has a tendency to flow into the federal government. I think it's important that we think of ourselves, like you said, the religious factor, what do the people really want? That's who's going to end up getting voted in. But I think more so as looking more to ourselves, I would think more of terms making the government smaller into individual areas, mm-hmm. but people don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If there's a power source out there that can bring us comfort, security, stability, we're going to want it. We're going to want to appeal to it. We're going to want it to become stronger and more capable of providing me with that peace and security. That's very human, but that's the problem.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You talked a little bit about kind of government needing to be larger as rebellion becomes larger. Mm-hmm. And if the people's agenda is comfort or a need to have a voice, I mean, look at our government and there's kind of large groups of kind of outlandish special interest and they lobby so that their voice can be heard. And because our government is not God himself, there has to be some softening of the lines so that the special interest can at least have the sense that their voice is being heard. And so I guess my question is, with those agendas in place for most of humanity, isn't government kind of a way to avoid the hard line that God is? Because God says, well, this is right and this is wrong. Mm-hmm. And many of us would not come to God with a special interest because we know that it's pretty cut and dry with God about that. Mm-hmm. And so isn't that sort of a way that we can all kind of hide from God to kind of say, well, my voice is more important than what God thinks is right or what God thinks is wrong?
Let me see if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly. Well, could you try it one more time? I'm sorry.
Can I say it deeper?
Yeah.
So let's say there's a special interest that, we should be able to kill children because we have this special group and that's our religious belief. And so we come to the United States government and we lobby for that. Mm-hmm. And so the government says, well, it's not okay to kill children, but it's okay to hurt them. Mm-hmm. So they kind of soften the lines mm-hmm. a little bit. Mm-hmm. Well, if we came with that agenda to God and we mm-hmm. said we'd like to kill children, God would say, no, but I'd like to kill you.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like a pretty... Right. And so weren't the people of Israel kind of crying out, hey, we kind of don't want to have to wrestle with our own problems and our own agony. We want somebody that will soften the blow of that for us.
Right. We want something with the power of God, but that's responsive to the human appeal. So we want something...
For sinfulness.
We want something omnipotent. We want something that's omnipotent, but that will respond to my needs.
Or agree to my needs.
Yes, with my priorities. We know we aren't gods. So if we just had a God that would just respond to me automatically the way I want him to respond, that'd be great. Well, the state becomes kind of that kind of entity that we think that we want it to be powerful. We want it to be able to do a lot of things. And then we want it to respond to my list of concerns in order. And that's disastrous.
Well, and I see the frenzy, you know, like, oh, the next president, we have to have it right, next president, because the next president is going to be the one that's going to kind of have our voice be heard and solve our problems. Yeah. And I'm just going to go,
yeah,
wow, look at the track record.
Yeah, yeah, right, right, absolutely.
It's an interesting dichotomy here between God dealing with Israel as a group and God dealing with Israelites as individuals. Mm-hmm. If they cry out to have a king to run everything and make the decisions and keep it working, they're saying, we don't want to be bothered with taking care of ourselves. Benjamin and Ephraim and Dan, we don't want to have to say, well, these guys got this great area of the country where they can grow a lot of stuff, but we have the area where we can mine a lot of stuff. And so now we got to work out this deal between us where we trade resources,
right,
and everybody comes out feeling like they've been treated well.
Right.
Now, on the one hand, we talk about how God deals with Israel as a group, and the covenant is in a group. But here he seems to be saying that he wants to force upon every individual Hebrew the moral accountability for their own lives and to create their own social network so that the nation works in righteousness. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to appoint one guy to pass a bunch of laws and wield the sword to force you all to live like civilized human beings. Mm-hmm. And yet they kind of have this sense that, well, if he does that, we'll fail. So let's have one guy make all the choices and enforce all the rules. And is that really what's going on?
Well, I think that's part of it. The bigger the government, the more the inclination will be on the part of those who are subject to that government to not think in terms of being responsible for their own actions. Because the government does that. I mean, we've done that with a great example of that would be welfare. We have come to the place where we think that it is the government's job to take care of the poor. Well, that's a horrible development because they can't do it, but we're relieved of a sense of responsibility for that. So that's the worst of both worlds. So as government grows, there's a huge temptation for us to see our responsibility as being less. And I think that's one of the dynamics at play. Does that mean that they should never have had a centralized administration? I don't know that it necessarily means that, but it does mean that we always have to be on our lookout for that particular dynamic and what that does to us.
So as for my question about this seemingly two-handed administration of the covenant, is God forcing the covenant down into the individual lives by not having a king? Is there a responsibility for them to address the law of Moses, take it into their homes and say, this should rule our lives, and if we do this, this kingdom's going to work?
I don't know. Are you asking then, if the Israelites had been obedient, would they have been eternally anarchists? Is that essentially what you're asking?
I mean, that has been so heavy with connotation.
I know.
I mean,
I'm just making it stark.
Let me say it this way. If they had established and maintained the religious discipline that they that it seems to me like not having this king would have done to them. Would it have worked at least as a civilization because within the law was enough principle on being human and living together that it would have worked?
If, I don't know, if they were seeking after righteousness, if that were a higher priority than security and stability, it seems to me that their anarchy could have worked. In the absence of an orientation towards righteousness, anarchy is going to be the first to fail. I mean, the failure is going to be obvious much more readily than if you've got some kind of administrative structure that imposes order where there's no basis for order. You see what I'm saying? So I'm not convinced that what God was intending for them was eternal anarchy. I think that he foresaw the need for administrative structure as things got more complex. But one way or another, whether it's through circumstances or whether it's us talking to one another, it's critical that we make sure that hungering and thirsting after righteousness doesn't slip from the number one position. Because if it does, that's catastrophic.
Is it possible that the Deuteronomy section that you quoted, is it possible that it's, I want to preserve them asking some nasty thing.
Okay.
I think the picture, the biblical picture that is spun out of that, like the sort of thing that you and Ron were talking about, is just more vivid if they're asking something nasty. So just at a gut level, I'm being honest with you. I like the nasty question thing.
Right.
Is it possible that it's just, it seems that there's, it's going, you're going to say this. And in fact, they do say this. And the way that they say it is out of wickedness.
Right.
So rather than necessarily going, you're going to say this from just the necessities of politics and life and all that stuff. It's just making an indicative statement of fact. You're going to say this.
Right.
Is it possible that it's going, that the writers know this is going to be out of wickedness, but it's still making provisions, even if they're asking out of wickedness? It's kind of like Paul, okay, disagree, but don't consume yourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if you're going to disagree, you know, so be it, but make sure you don't devour one another.
Right.
That sort of concession. Like, if you're going to ask for a king, so be it, but make sure, if that's the case, if that's what you're going to do, make sure he writes down the law, make sure he doesn't multiply horses. And please don't go back to Egypt because, you know, God.
Right.
Like,
yes, I think the language allows for that. The only thing that got me to reconsider that is there are other places where it says what will happen and they're bad things. For instance, it says that they will forget that God provide them the cisterns that they did not dig and the vineyards that they did not plant and all that sort of thing. That there are, I can think of other places in Deuteronomy where it predicts what will happen, but it makes it clear that that's a bad thing. And here it doesn't make it clear that that's a bad thing. So that's what gives me pause. But could it be that what you're saying is the way it should be taken? Yes, that could be.
Very thought-provoking. Thank you. I was struck by several things. And you can elaborate on this better than I can. But mostly the theme is the stress that you put on our lust for security, as you put it, is really something I need to think about, and all the implications of that. Seems like it has implications for our personal lives as well as our social and political lives.
Absolutely.
You have pointed out to me, you have taught to me, that the Romans never set out to conquer the world. They just felt insecure because of the enemies around them. In order to establish security, they kept beating up on their neighbors until, lo and behold, they had the whole world or most of the world.
Yeah, they just kept getting more neighbors.
Yeah. And the thing that's fascinating about that is we look back on that and talk about the glory of Rome, but the Bible always presents them as a monster, as a beast. Mm-hmm. And that struck me as you were talking about how ultimately evil and wicked and insidious our lust for security is. It brutalizes us. It makes us into beasts. We don't behave the way we ought to behave. So maybe you could comment on that. That's enough.
Well, I don't know that I have any more to comment on that, but that's, I think that is what it's talking about here. I think that that's true. And that is really scary. because we face so much discomfort and insecurity in the world, and it is so unpleasant.
Oh, just one quick comment. The other thing that occurred to me is that lust for security doesn't divide up between the left and the right,
right.
In our country.
Oh,
the difference between the left and the right is their vision of security, what constitutes security, not their lust for it.
We
all suffer that lust.
Yep. So. Okay, we need to stop. Thanks.